Greetings, all three sections. Sections 1 and 2, your first lab report is going to be due at the time lab starts on Monday the 6th. Your second lab report will be due on Wednesday the 9th. Section 3, your first lab report will be due at the beginning of lab, 7:30 in the morning, on Tuesday the 7th. And your second lab report will be due on Thursday the 9th. Sections 1 and 2, you will begin experiment 3 on Wednesday. So even though you have the exam coming up, you do have to have your pre-lab done. That's for this Wednesday upcoming, the 1st. Then for section 3, you do need to have your pre-lab done as well. And that will be for Thursday the 2nd. So as far as the two lab reports, almost anything that's in the syllabus related to lab reports needs to be pretty much ignored, because the syllabus was written really with Chem 1A in mind as far as all the detail, and so much of what is there is about how to format data and calculations and doing quantitative analysis. There'll be hardly any quantitative analysis in this lab report, so that's why we're going to use a highly simplified format. In fact, really, there's only 3 or 4 main components that you're going to put in here. You do need to have some sort of title still, but recognize that all we're doing is synthesis. So you can even make it as simple as something like synthesis of cyclododecanone. You're going to have your spectra or spectrum that you need to include. If you are going to be emailing your lab reports, then if you have the know-how and it doesn't take you long, you could just scan your spectra and include them with your lab report. Or if you don't have easy access to a scanner, don't want to hassle with the scanner, it's perfectly fine for you to email the rest of your report, but to then hand your spectrum in by hand. Or you aren't required to email your lab reports. I just prefer emailed lab reports. And so you could turn the entire report in printed out by hard copy. Whichever way you do it, you do need to make sure that your spectra do have the absorption numbers printed on it, the different frequencies, so that you could compare them to a spectra that you might be able to download online, which for those of you who aren't familiar with it, if you go to the main website page, not the page where the lecture notes are posted, but to the main index page, there is a link there that is for the AIST database, which is a listing, a database of different NMR and IR spectra, which in fact later on when I quote some of these absorbances, it's from these spectra that I've downloaded. Yes? The question was asked, if you're going to turn in the spectra by hand instead of by email, do you need to sign it in some way? You don't need my signature, but yes, please put your name on there. I know that often it prints names out automatically when you print the spectra out. And if you don't realize that, take a look at your spectra, because it might have other students' names from other people that entered that into the computer. But just cross it out, make sure your name is on it, and then yes, an experiment number so that it eventually can get back to you. Now, back to what needs to go into the report. You're going to have your spectra. The only other piece of information that really needs to include in the way of data are the masses you obtained, because you might remember at the beginning of the quarter I had indicated that I want you to always include a percent yield calculation, which if you haven't been measuring your masses, then I guess at this point I'll just say lie about it, which... In this sense, don't just say you didn't acquire the data. Try to be creative in this case, since I'm directing you to lie. You could say something like, well, due to poor manipulation of the samples were lost before an accurate mass could be obtained, and therefore the percent yield could not be calculated. I'll know that that means you didn't do it, but at least you knew enough to comment on it in your lab report, which at least you're following directions. And then just make sure for all future labs that you do all of your mass measurements so that you can calculate that percent yield. Aside from the percent yield, the only other thing that you're going to be doing is a spectral analysis. But since I've mentioned the percent yield, and given what the other sections that I had taught previously, their reaction towards stoichiometry, get the impression that maybe I want to do a little bit of review of how to figure out what percent yield is. So first off, let's look at the reaction of the oxidation of the alcohol to form the ketone. So in simplified format, I'm going to use R notation to represent the two halves of the ring. And so we have the alcohol, which reacts with bleach and an acid source to make the ketone. Just a review of something from last quarter. If we know that we started out with cyclododecanol, which has 12 carbons, and if we ignore the structure of the compound, just focus on the fact that it has 12 carbons, if it was a fully saturated compound, how many hydrogens would it have? Yes? 24. 26. It is actually 26. 24 is the right answer for this particular compound, but if it was fully saturated, remember that the formula for that is 2C plus 2. So 2 times the number of carbons plus 2, and that's because if you have a straight chain compound, each end would have an additional hydrogen. Of course, you have to add for the number of hydrogens or phosphoruses or other pentigens that you have in there, because they tend to be trivalent. But, or if you have halogens, you subtract one, because each one of those tends to be monovalent. In this case, we don't have either of those, we just have oxygen, and since oxygen's normally divalent, you can imagine an oxygen just inserting in between a carbon and hydrogen bond, and therefore not affecting the total hydrogen count. So, fully saturated compound should have 26, but yes, in this case it's 24, because the ring counts as a degree of unsaturation. Now, does anybody need to review what degree of unsaturation is? Okay, good. Moving on to the ketone then, we do have an additional degree of unsaturation, and so that goes from 24 now down to 22 hydrogens. Now, if we're going to do a stoichiometry calculation to determine percent yield, we need to figure out, well, which one of these things is the limiting reagent. Well, the ketone's not it, because it's the product. So out of everything else, we look and realize that we had the solution of bleach, where we just added an excess of bleach. And so that's going to make the alcohol the limiting reagent. And so we start out with the half gram, which half gram may be the quantity you were told to use in your lab procedure, but do make sure that you put in your actual quantity there. And recognize that if you use the analytic balances, that those have 4 digits after the decimal point. And so you need to make sure you report all 4 so that you report fully all the data that you acquired. You don't want to throw away significant figures. Similarly, since everything else I'm about to show you in this calculation is a multiplication or a division, you want to make sure that you don't overly round your molar masses. At least use 4 digits in those as well. So we start out with the mass, about a half gram. Reactions occur on the basis of numbers, not on the basis of mass. And so therefore, I need to convert to moles, because moles a number. So I'm going to divide by the molar mass of the alcohol, C12H24. That'll give us moles of the alcohol. I then am going to multiply by 1. And that's because if I'm doing careful unit analysis, I don't want how many moles of alcohol, I want to see how much of the ketone I should have formed. So all these unit conversion factors tend to work on the lines of what do you want divided by what do you got. So we're going to multiply by 1 mole of the ketone over 1 mole of the alcohol. Of course, we didn't measure the product in terms of moles, we measured it in terms of mass, and so I'm going to multiply now by the molar mass of the ketone. That'll give me the theoretical mass that I should have gotten if the reaction went completely successfully. Percent yield, then, would be the mass that you obtained divided by this theoretical mass that we just calculated, multiplied by 100%. So you do need to make sure to include a percent yield The main part of the analysis in this lab, though, is going to be on your spectral analysis, which we can compare just really quickly what your reactant and product is going to look like for both lab 1 and lab 2. And the results are really going to be opposite of each other, because in lab 1 we took an alcohol to make a ketone, in lab 2 we took a ketone to make an alcohol. Now, what you do not need to do is try to do a peak-by-peak analysis. If this was a more advanced O-Chem class, maybe it would have us all worry about what every single absorbance corresponds to. What we're really trying to do, though, is just ensure whether or not the reaction occurred. And so, for example, in lab 1, your starting material graph might look something like this, where you've got this big rounded curve that appears around 3200. You might see the alkyl absorbance. So just having different alkyl groups, carbon-carbon single bonds, that often shows up at about 2900. And then we've got all these other peaks down towards the right-hand side of the spectrum, which we're not, in this case, going to analyze. Now, this spectrum, you don't have to include. It's just the starting material. But if you wanted to take a look at the spectrum, it is available in your text. In fact, all of the spectra of your products and reactants are available in the text. It's just they lack the specific absorption numbers, which I kind of theorized out loud the other day might be due to the fact that the textbook author might have been worried that someone could read the procedure, take these graphs, and make their own lab report without ever having done the lab. Of course, in real life, you can get this information online anyway, so why they didn't include it in the text, I don't know. But that's why I referred to this database link that I have on my website, because I did download some quantitative information from there. Now, again, if you download anything, don't put that in your lab report, because it's just for comparative purposes. But from that downloaded spectrum, the absorption for the alcohol showed up at 3268. I didn't write down the number for the alkyl absorption, because both the product and reactant are going to have it, and so it's not really worthwhile for what we're doing to comment on it. What you want to see, though, is that alcohol, the starting material that has that OH peak, should not have that OH peak at all if the reaction went completely successfully. Instead, you should have this carbonyl peak. So you'll have the alkyl peak in the product, and then that carbonyl peak, again with some other stuff further to the right of the spectrum that we're ignoring. Carbonyl peaks are often the second most identifiable functional group in IR, because alcohols give that nice, big, characteristic, broad OH peak, but carbonyls tend to give a very characteristic, sharp peak in the high 1600, low 1700 range. And for the particular product, the absorbance for carbonyl was at 1706. So there's really three scenarios I envision here. Unfortunately, the one that you would want may not be the most common. The one that you want is so in your product, you see absolutely no evidence of that OH peak. So it's disappeared. But you see only the carbonyl peak. We would interpret that as the reaction having gone successfully. Definitely the thing you want the least to see is if you only have the alcohol peak and not the carbonyl peak. Because if that's so, then the only thing you could say is that, well, it looks like the reaction didn't work because you didn't get any ketone. What most of you probably got is both, that you've got some carbonyl peak and alcohol peak, which I would interpret this way. It means that the reaction was at least partially successful, because if it wasn't, you wouldn't have any carbonyl. But because you have the alcohol peak, one of two things is true. Either you have unreacted starting material that's still around, or maybe, no matter how careful you were, you still had water that was around, because water will also generate the same type of OH peak. So whatever your case may be, this is what you need to include in your lab report. And again, you don't have to list every single peak and say what it means. Now again, you want to look at the changes and see how those changes can justify you saying you did or did not make your product. And again, the three scenarios that I outlined were the following. You have the carbonyl peak only, or you have the alcohol peak only, or you have both. And respectively, that would have meant completely successful reaction, completely unsuccessful reaction, or question mark. You made some product, but you're not sure if it's just wet, meaning there's water around, or if there's an alcohol that's giving you that extra OH peak. Questions on that first lab report. Then on the second lab report, it's pretty much everything in reverse. You start out with a compound that has a ketone. And that ketone, according to the downloaded spectrum, shows up at 1722. Now notice for this compound, you shouldn't really have that alkyl absorbance because everything is sp2 hybridized in that starting material. So really the only prominent peak you should comment on in the starting material is the ketone, which, if the reaction was successful, should totally disappear in the product. And instead, you should have the alcohol peak, which, curiously enough, on the downloaded spectrum seemed to be split. And so one of the main absorbances was at 3188. So, again, three scenarios. If you end up with only the alcohol peak, then you could say the reduction was successful. Now, there is the possibility there's water there also, so you can't say that it's just the alcohol, unfortunately. But what you could say is the reaction must have been successful. Same second scenario, just in reverse. If you only have the carbonyl peak, that means the ketone didn't get reduced, which means the reaction was unsuccessful. Or there is also the possibility that somehow it got lost in the handling during the recrystallization, for example. Again, the most likely, the third scenario, is where you would have both the alcohol and the carbonyl peaks, which would mean at least you'd think that the reaction was partially successful. Yes, it could be water that's there, but sodium borohydride usually just works. So I'm presuming that as long as you didn't destroy the sodium borohydride, that you got some alcohol product. But if you also have the carbonyl peak, that does mean the reaction did not go to completion, so it wasn't completely successful. And one last time, this is the type of analysis that you need to have in your report. So, a title, your spectrum, your interpretation of the spectrum, and calculation of percent yield. And just to make sure, these are due at the beginning of your lab period. So those of you emailing me, that means you need to make sure before you get here that the email was sent. Any questions about the second lab report? Then what I'm going to do next is I'm going to put up a series of synthesis problems. And these synthesis problems are not just to scare you, and they're not supposed to be the only types of things that may show up on your exam. They're just my opportunity to show you a few common synthetic tricks since we're still learning synthesis. And I really would prefer not to give any help on these problems at first. Really want you to struggle with them on your own because you're not going to have me to be able to take the exam for you. Now we'll go over the answers in just a while, but I want you to work on these as much as you can on your own, or if you do end up with some time, you can work on them with your friends in lab. Now, do recognize, though, that you are still in lab, so even if you're done with the experiment for the day and you're just working on your synthesis problems, you still have to have your goggles on the whole time. So at this point, let's go ahead and begin lab. And then close to the end of lab, I won't stop us. You can keep working, but I'll turn the lights back off since you have your hood lights, and we'll go over the answers to these synthesis problems. Let's go over these synthesis problems. The first one might have been the most difficult because it did require recognizing a variation to a reaction that we learned last quarter. So you all hopefully did get that sheet with the list of reactions from 12A. And the first problem involves taking a ketone and making what almost would look like a halohydrate, something that's got an oxygen on one carbon and right next door a bromine. And so some of you might have struggled with, well, how do you put both of those functional groups on at the same time? And what I'd seen in the other sections is people try to use Br2, making a dibromide and somehow reacting one or the other, but that's kind of tough to do. It turns out, though, that if you take an alkene and react it with bromine and not water, but an alcohol, that the alcohol will add in the same way that water would. So in order to get both of those functional groups on at the same time, all you really need to do is add the alcohol to the alkene by using bromine. So bromine is attacked first, makes the cyclic intermediate, then the alcohol attacks, pushes the ring open. So what that does mean is if we back up retrosynthetically one step, we need an alkene and we need that alcohol. Well, the alcohol can be synthesized easily. If you take the ketone and react it with either lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride, either one. And then follow it with acid workup. That'll get you the alcohol. Now, I've seen this a couple of times now. And let me just stress that for reducing an aldehyde or a ketone, normally sodium hydride is not a good choice. And that's because the boron in sodium borohydride or the aluminum in lithium aluminum hydride do participate somewhat in the mechanism, which is something that we'll discuss after the exam, after today's class lecture. So lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride. From the alcohol, we could continue on to make the alkene, which there's a couple of different ways you could go about that. Since there's only one alkene that could possibly be formed, dehydration might not be a bad approach to take in this case. And there is that reagent which we haven't covered yet, and so if we haven't covered it, it's not something you have to know yet, but if you did study the POCL3, P-O-C-L-3, then that could be used to dehydrate as well. Or instead of dehydration, we could try to do an elimination, which OH itself is not a leaving group, so you can't eliminate directly. But you could, for example, convert it into an alkyl halide first. So, for example, using thionyl chloride, and then doing an elimination using a strong hindered base. Once you get those two pieces, then you react the alkene with the alcohol at the same time you react with bromine, and that gets you the product. So questions on that first synthesis? Yes? As I was saying, the boron or the aluminum in those reducing agents actually complexes with the oxygen, and that partly helps the hydride attack. You don't have that occurring in sodium hydride. So sodium hydride is usually used when you want H- as a base. So for example, when we're deprotonating alcohols to make alkoxides. There we wouldn't use lithium aluminum hydride, although technically you could, but it'd be a waste of the reagent. So for reductions, you use lithium aluminum hydride, sodium borohydride. For deprotonation, use just sodium hydride. Other questions? Yes?
figured out? Okay.
Yes?
What does the secondary alcohol do to the alkene?
What does the secondary alcohol do? It doesn't do anything to the alkene. If I wrote the mechanism out, it would look like this. First, the bromine gets attacked, and optionally, some people show an arrow coming back to the alkene to highlight the fact that you do end up with a bridged intermediate. It's exactly that kind of intermediate that I mentioned when we did the epoxide opening, because this is that same situation where we have a three-membered ring that's strained, and it's going to be the bond to the secondary carbon that's weaker because of the potential to form the more favorable positive charge. So the alcohol, if you make that the solvent, it outpopulates the bromine. So instead of bromine attacking, it's the alcohol. And then there's just one final step where you get deprotonation. And let me just be clear, though, I've shown the mechanism just to help answer the question, but on a test, you would not have to write mechanism. In fact, I'd say don't, because it'll just slow you down. Other questions on this problem? So hopefully you could have figured out how to make the alkene part of it, or at the very least, how to get to the alcohol. If you didn't realize this little trick about making a modified bromohydrin, that's okay. That is the tricky part of this problem, and that's why I showed you this problem. But let's go ahead and move on to the second problem then. That one was what?
Keep forgetting.
Oh, yes. The one that to many of you might be the most annoying problem, because you probably came up with all kinds of answers that got you close to the right answer, but the problem is, well, how do you deal with the deuterium? Because let me show you a couple things that won't work. If you tried to do just plain hydration, in section one, so you all, for the most part, didn't do what section one did. Section one, they kept wanting hints and answers, and I just said no, because I wanted them to try to work on their own. I wanted to challenge you a little. But they kept asking, well, is there such thing? Can we use D plus and D minus and D all these other things? Yes, of course. Because deuterium's just an isotope of hydrogen. So, for example, if you could use H plus as an acid catalyst, yes, you could use D plus as an acid catalyst. You just have deuterium end up on a molecule instead. But if you tried, for example, to do just plain hydration using D plus and water, first of all, the deuterium is going to go to the least substituted position, because that's what happens in a Markovnikov addition anyways. Second of all, since you form a carbocation, you get carbocation migration. And so the OH group's not even going to end up where you want it to. So that route just doesn't work. Someone else suggested, okay, what about the oxymercuration demercuration version of it? Well, that's possible. You could start with mercury acetate and water. And before I show you step two, let's see what we would get that far. Mercury acetate and water. Water adds to the more substituted position. But the mercury acetate ends up at the least substituted position. So again, even if we reduced it with a deuterium agent, the deuterium is going to still end up in the wrong place. At least the alcohol is in the right place now. But if I did follow through and did the step two with lithium aluminum deuteride, get the wrong product. Same thing happens with borane. In that case, if you tried to do hydroboration, well, that would completely get you the wrong answer. Although someone came up with a creative solution that, again, got close. They made an alcohol and then dehydrated or eliminated to put the alkene to the more substituted position. They then said, okay, let's use borane, because then that's going to put the alcohol in the right place, which it does. But in that case, the deuterium would still go to a different carbon. So how in the world can you get a deuterium onto the same places where an alcohol is going to form? You make an epoxide?
No.
Yes. Right.
And then you put
DBR. But the D's would still go to the more substituted position, or the less substituted position. So it still wouldn't put deuterium in the right place. But what other way do you know how to make an alcohol besides from an alkene? What about from a ketone? Because if you think about it, the way that you reduce a carbonyl, the hydrogen attacks the carbon, pushes open the carbonyl bond, gives you an alcohol. Well, what if you had deuterium attack a carbonyl instead? Then that would give you the deuterium in exactly the right place. So, you need an alcohol to then oxidize to the ketone to reduce it right back down again. And yeah, I know that's kind of tricky, but that's why I'm showing you this as an example problem. More generally, you should be aware that aldehydes and ketones often are starting materials for alcohols. So, how could we have done this? Well, we don't know a way of going directly from this alkene to a ketone. So we're going to need the alcohol first. We don't want the alcohol to rearrange, so it can't be hydration. What you could do, actually there's two ways to get there. The direct way is to do oxymercuration, demercuration. Technically, we could get there another route. If we use MCPBA, we'll make an epoxide. You might remember that just our last lecture, I told you that you can use lithium aluminum hydride to pop open an epoxide. The hydride would attack at the less substituted position, leaving the alcohol at the more substituted position, which once you neutralize, we get the product we want, that secondary alcohol. Once we have the alcohol, we can then oxidize using Jones reagent, aqueous chromium trioxide. That gets us the ketone. Now, if we use lithium aluminum deuteride or sodium borodeuteride and reduce, it puts the deuterium in the right place. And we get the alcohol. Just to show you, you can introduce deuterium other places. This is not the answer we want, but what would happen if I used sodium borohydride followed by D plus? Well, in the product, the hydrogen and deuterium shown would swap places. Since it's lithium hydride, the hydrogen would attack the carbonyl bond. But since I use D plus as the neutralizing agent, the deuterium would end up on the alcohol. Questions on that second synthesis? Then let's move on to the third. Show it to you, it would be counted correct because if you do the right sequence, it just in real life would not be the fastest way to get there. So what someone had come up with is this as a way of making that secondary alcohol. First, react it with Br2. Makes the vicinal dihalide. React that with two equivalents of a strong base, like sodium amide. That makes the alkyne. Using a mercury catalyst in acidic conditions, it puts an alcohol, but it puts the alcohol where an alkene is, which means it would tautomerize. And so you get the ketone. So yes, you could have done that as well. And if you did that, and you did that sequence, it would have been correct. Other questions? So, but let me turn that around then, to say there's not one correct answer on many of these problems. There can be many correct answers, and you'll be given full credit, not based on the length of your synthesis, but whether every step is correct or not. Let's move to the third one, because that was hopefully the easiest one. So if you're worried that you didn't get these first two, maybe this will hopefully make you feel a little better. To convert an alcohol into a vicinal dihalide. Part of the point of this sample problem was to get at something I'd mentioned the other day in lecture, which is that if you end up with two functional groups right next door to each other, probably came from an alkene, an alkyne, or an epoxide. Because those are all functional groups that bridge two carbons. And we have a functional group that shows up at two different carbons. Well, a dihalide, you know, comes from an alkene just by reacting with Br2. Now, it is true, I have not shown you stereochemistry here. And so, and in section 1 and 2, if you're listening, I didn't actually think of this variation of the problem. And I'll show you what would happen if you had to worry about stereochemistry in just a moment. But ignoring stereochemistry, I could make a dihalide if I just had an alkene. Well, because this is a symmetric alcohol, there's only one product you would get if you tried to dehydrate, it would be perfectly fine to dehydrate here. And then once you have that alkene, just react with bromine. Now, two comments on that. One, this would make a vicinal dihalide with anti-addition, meaning that the two groups would be oppositely pointed from each other, which in this ring case means you'd end up with a trans compound. Because the double bond is planar, you would have gotten enantiomers of that trans compound. So let me just put in parentheses here that if we had to worry about stereochemistry, you'd need to know what stereochemistry would result. Now, you don't know how to isolate one enantiomer versus another. So in a synthesis that does make enantiomers, don't worry about the fact you have enantiomers. Just go with it because that's all you know synthetically at the moment. Now, what if I had shown you, though, that I wanted to take this alcohol and specifically make a case where the Br groups are both pointed the same way as each other? Well, not much of a problem. We just have to be sneaky. We still dehydrate. We still use Br2, but Br2 with water. You'll make enantiomers, and I'm only showing one of them. But the bromine and OH group would end up opposite to each other. But since PBr3 causes inversion of configuration anyways, it would make the alcohol pop around and give us the right stereochemistry. So regardless of what the stereochemistry was, we have a way of getting there. Yes? So the question was, could you use something like HBr, where the alcohol would get protonated and then a bromine could come in and kick the alcohol off? Yes, it is possible to do that kind of thing, except that in that specific case, you might get the same reaction occur, but in an SN1 style, where the alcohol would get protonated, a carbocation would form, and then the halide would come in to attack. So it could, in theory, work, but you might get a mixture of products. If it were a primary position, then yes, that's the way it would occur. And that's a reaction we'll cover after the exam. I don't want to confuse us by introducing it in this late date. Other questions on this problem? Then the last one, and then we'll need to wrap up, was a problem I might have done the other day in class, or a variation of it. And the reason for showing this problem is to highlight one of the few ways that we've learned to make a carbon-carbon bond. Especially after today's lecture, you're going to start getting the idea that making or breaking carbon-carbon bonds is really important in synthesis. So, I can use an alkyne to make a new carbon-carbon bond. Because imagine that we had these two pieces. Something with a leaving group, and then an alkyne salt, an acetylide ion. That does SN2, which afterwards you'd still have the triple bond, but you could just hydrogenate and get rid of that. So the question is, how could we make a leaving group like that at that correct position? Well, notice that that would be anti-Markovnikov from the perspective of the original compound. So there's two ways you can go about it. One is, if you remember that modified borane reagent from last quarter, where you put two alkyl groups on the borane, follow that up by oxidative workup, it initially forms an enol, puts an alcohol at the less substituted position. But because it's also an alkene, it's an enol, it tautomerizes, and we end up with an aldehyde. That aldehyde we could then reduce to make an alcohol. Now, if you're not familiar with that special reagent, I'll rewrite it out in its more full form. Now, if you didn't remember that reagent, but you still thought about borane, trying to get something at the anti-Markovnikov position, we could have tried to get to the alkene, which, since this alkyne can't make a cis or transalkene, there's only one group on one side of the alkyne, we had two choices. We could have done hydrogen with Lindler's catalyst, or sodium in ammonia. They both would have made the same alkene, which then you could react with regular borane and work it up to make that same alcohol. Once we make the alcohol, we need a leaving group. So above I showed bromide. You could use tosyl chloride, make a tosylate instead. No problem with that. The alkyne, you deprotonate, which sodium hydride might work, I need to look up the pK of hydrogen. But this is the reagent you saw last quarter, so just to be consistent, that's why I'm showing this. That forms the acetylide salt. Throw those two compounds together. It makes the 6-carbon alkyne, which you hydrogenate to make hexane. Questions on that last synthesis?